Well, today on Trust the Problem, I'm going to look into something that I think is kind of deep and interesting and not well understood in our culture. And it's about intuition, superstition, and faith. And it's sort of coming up a great deal these days in our world because there's so much that going on with religion, and then there's also the issues of superstition. When do religion and superstition overlap? Sometimes people think one man's religion is another man's superstition. But that's just one little piece of it. The really important part is what intuition is and how the intuitive mind thinks. And that's sort of been my specialty for 35 years, is to really analyze how the intuitive mind thinks. And it is quite a mystery to our very linear, logical, not only our culture, but through the millennia, actually, there have always been cycles where intuition gets stronger. But pretty much, especially since Roman time, civilization has been very dominantly linear-minded. And I use a story that I tell that I heard on PBS years and years ago. There was a medical doctor talking to a patient and who had a brain tumor, and he said to the patient, "Well, fortunately, you have a tumor on the side of the brain where it doesn't matter." And, of course, you know, that was the right brain, the left brain, which is the right side of the body, left brain. And so what I realized was that the linear, logical, he had the tumor on the intuitive mind side, which is the right brain and the left side of the body. I had it right the first time. And the logical side, ruled by the left brain, is the right side of the body. And that's always what makes it a little confusing, is because the left side of the body rules the right brain, and the other way around, the right brain rules the left side of the body. I'm certainly making this confusing, I apologize. And the right brain rules the left side of the body. And what happens, and I think it's significant that there's that crossover, and it's significant, too, that it's confusing to us because we want to make it black and white. We want to make it how it is. And, of course, the real punchline to the whole story is that we have one brain, and it has two hemispheres that think in two different styles. And in using the two different styles in a mature way, we become integrated. In fact, they can't really integrate very well until they mature. And so it's very important to keep thinking about what mature intuition looks like and what mature logic looks like. Because by following that guideline, we mature ourselves and we integrate ourselves and we get what we supposedly are really all looking for, which is enlightenment, to be able to be more awake, more aware, understand healing, understand each other, be able to love more honestly, to be able to communicate more honestly, if I've already been two shows about truth, because the truth is such a powerful base. It heals by having the correct information coming in, or at least the intent, the desire, the power of your intention to be open to what is wholesome. And that changes how your intuitive mind works, and it also allows your linear mind to be concerned about what's accurate, which is what's helpful. Because a linear mind can work against us by needing to be right so much that we get all these defenses that actually, as I've already talked about, screen things out, have selective thinking, selective memory, so that we can look right. And that doesn't help us. That's one of the things that really just doesn't help us. And we have to see that that is immature and that that's something we shouldn't be doing because it doesn't help. It makes us hurt. It makes us hurt others. So today I wanted to talk about intuition, superstition, and faith because this is the blooming insight. This is the blooming consciousness. This is the new thing that is struggling to mature into our awareness and not be rooted in fear. And fear, I've always said, is the greatest sin. Promoting fear is the greatest sin. Sin being the archery term for off the mark, where you don't hit it on the target. It's the when we promote fear in people to get power over them, usually, or just by venting our own fears, what we're doing is compounding the ruthlessness, the ability to be unkind. Now, intuition, as I've already started to talk about, is right brain thinking. It's the hemisphere that sees in pictures, feelings, music, metaphor, parable. It's vision. It's the sense of the whole. It's the more, the ineffable, more than the sum of the parts. It's the something that you cannot nail down as a thing, but connects it. So intuition is incredibly powerful and important. And when we misunderstand or misuse intuition or are immature about it, it tends towards superstition. It's like we want an answer, so the linear mind wants an answer as to why something happened, which is fine impulse, except that when we can't find it, we make it up with the intuitive mind. And that's what a superstition is. It's the answer we made up. Now, the hard thing, apparently, but not actually, the hard thing seems to be that that's how creativity works. You have a problem, you can't solve it, you go to the intuitive mind, and it makes up an answer. The difference between an answer that's a superstition and an answer that's an insight is whether you're rooted in fear and control and power over and are trying to manipulate an outcome, which degrades your intuitive ability into superstition. Or you are using your intuition as inspiration, as an open mind, as a heartfelt seeking and wondering, as dream in the sense of vision. And, of course, the dreams ourselves, a whole other venue here to talk about sleeping dreams and the kinds of dreams we have. And it's not an accident that we call dreams that are our vision and dreams that are our dreams at night the same name. They come from the same place, but they really are a bit different. Because the dream at night when you're sleeping is the right brain more unfettered by the logical mind's rules. And that's why it's necessary to dream. Because we have to keep integrating the data. We have to keep integrating the events of our life, the problems, the difficulties, the things that come up. We have to keep having a new way to see it. Otherwise, we're stagnant and there's no creativity. And there's really no life force. It's just recording. It's a lot like a computer. You know, computers can be quite wonderful. They can record a lot of things. But they're really only as good as the information we put in. And they're really only as good as the information is updated. And as things, if we get to one conclusion, that gives us a new perspective where, you know, it's like what happens when you climb to the top of the mountain. You see there's 6 more mountains. And so what we need is that perspective. So we still have to go through the process of climbing the first mountain. And we still have to go through the process of the first insight on an issue or a problem. We still have to go through the process of questioning in an innocent way, well, what can I do about this? And the secret always is two main big things for solving problems is correction at the source, and allowing your mind to be open so you can be inspired. And, of course, inspired gives you the idea, and the correction is when you realize you need it, when you realize something's not straight, something's not okay. This is beginning to be a problem. Something is not working right. As soon as you realize that, you want to look at whatever that problem is, and go straight to the source of where you can most find where it began. I used to tell people one of the things to do is to set up like a little video camera in your mind's eye. And when you're having an argument or difficulty or finally you have a realization something could be dangerous, or you get frustrated, you get angry, you can't have a discussion with somebody without moving into that frustrated place, or powerless place, not know how to respond, sometimes it manifests as, well, when you have that, what you need to do is just pause, go away. I always tell people, go down, excuse me, go into the bathroom, close the door, and then breathe and think. And one of the things you think of is set a little video camera in your mind, and you replay backwards into time so that when the person first said something and it bugged you, play back to that time, and then you play back to just a few minutes before that time. And what you will find always, if you let yourself observe you and your feelings and your body and your thoughts, and you let yourself observe the other person as best you can perceive it, you will always find that something was said or came up, something happened that you felt frightened about, that you slipped into a defensive mode that was kind of unconscious, and you went on automatic pilot, and out of your mouth came a response that was really the defense speaking. And then the problem began. This is true even if it's the other person doing something not good. This isn't about blame here. This is about understanding the energetic dynamic to undo it. Usually it's an interaction of wounds on both sides that are triggering each other. And how intuition helps is that it lets you first visualize, because that's the visualizing mind. It lets you visualize, go back, and feel it energetically. So it isn't just about logic, who's right, who's wrong, but a visualization of what went on. And when we go back like that, and we know, we have the knowledge, which is a sort of like faith, too. I mean, faith is the inspiration to keep moving in a healthy direction. So when we have that knowledge about this suggestion that we can do this, we have this power to do this, and we think of what's a correction I could invent right there at the source when that started to get weird, what's a better response? What's a better view of the whole problem? A more comprehensive one. What's something I need to know? This is all inspiration. This is the intuitive mind inspiring you, bringing you new information. And what happens is then that you give yourself the creativity to invent new responses for correction at the source, rather than go on, as most of us do, with a kind of childish tit-for-tat battle, where things simmer in resentment, and we just wait, you know, we swallow it, or we just wait till it comes up again, and then we kind of explode because we let it simmer too long or swallow too much, and we make a sarcastic comment, and we still don't address it from the position of feeling. We don't address it from the position of faith, from the position of intuition, from the position of being a grown-up. We don't address it with that innocence and straightforwardness. I just recently re-saw the movie Big. I love this movie. It's so funny, and I saw it with my grandson. And one of the funny parts is when she tells this other guy who's real ambitious, who she's been dating, who's mean and dominating and wants to win and resents this 13-year-old guy in a man's body who has innocence and creativity because it's not all stomped away. And when she breaks up with him to be with this man that's really only a 13-year-old, she says to him, he says, what's so great about him? Well, he's a grown-up. And what I love about it is that in a very real way, we are more grown-up in our thinking, not in our experience, not in our knowledge, not in our physical power, not in our repertoire capability, but we are more grown up in our innocence when we are young. Because what we have not realized is that by looking cool and faking it and being dominating and needing to be right and following all those defense mechanisms, we have arrested our development. We have arrested our development at not only an very immature level, an immature level that feels powerlessness and resents its innocence. When we resent our own innocence, we become mean people because we will resent innocence in other people. Because it will be so painful when we see it. And that's why in this movie it's such a great sort of metaphor. The intuitive mind just is giving this vision of the innocence is a threat. It's powerful, it's creative, it's playful, it gets the girl. it disarms our heart. It reveals our heart connection and our open-mindedness, reveals it to us. And so intuition is all part of this because innocence is intuition uncensored. It's intuition not beat up by the linear mind sphere. And it can go into superstition every time it needs a quick answer when it doesn't have enough information. So one of the characteristics of creative people and intuitive creative people and logical intuitive creative people, in other words, integrated people, which is what makes you be creative, is that they keep track of facts factually, so they use their linear mind well, can speak, can communicate in your mind, but they stay in touch with the open-mindedness, which is the intuition, and the allowing a new thought to come into being, so it's not all boxed out by the logical defenses. And this is our leap in consciousness. This is the evolutionary leap. This is how we live on the growing edge, which is what I've called it for decades, is that we're coming to this opening place. And it's taken us about 3 decades to sort of lift the lid, to begin the process, and just sort of mull around in it and let technology develop and let the problems grow and synthesize what we could and mature where we could. And this is what has been going on. But the thing that's interesting is that it's speeding up because there's a synergy. And what the intuitive mind does is let us make a connection that's real, even beyond words, just by being alive. And when you start living on this growing edge, when you cultivate your innocence, when you are aware that you might be being superstitious about something, and I do want to go into that a little bit more to describe what I mean by that, because superstition is, as I said, a way for the logical mind to have an explanation so it isn't paralyzed by fear sometimes. But it also has another wonderful function, which is part of the intuitive part, which is it invents a ritual or an image or a prayer or a vision that lets us relax, lets us use our intuitive capability and intelligence to a higher order. This is the essence of the beauty of religion, when religion is really religion, when it's the link to that which is greater. Very interesting now, and we call things organized religion. That's almost an oxymoron, because real religion doesn't organize to political organization, to people organization, to power control rule organization. Real religion is, by the definition of the word and the root meaning of the word, is the link to that which is greater. So when we experience the link to that which is greater and we acknowledge and are aware that all human beings and perhaps all sentient things have this link to that which is greater, it's the connection to God, it's the connection sometimes we call it the Holy Spirit or Shakti or Chi, or it's that flow, the flow of the universe. When we realize that these things are all connected and that that is that energy that is connecting everything, when we open to an image that lets us align with that and calm our insecurities, it is a healing experience. It is a spiritual, religious experience. What unfortunately happens when we're immature is we think that our spiritual, religious experience, or one that someone had who we see really was affected and it feels really genuine, so when we see someone else has had one, we think everybody should do it the way they did it, or everybody should do it the way we did it, as though that's the only way. And of course, metaphors are as numerous as minds can conceive, and moments in existence there are to conceive them. And they enrich as we let them move. So we don't want to stagnate them and box them. On the other hand, as long as they are inspiring and bringing joy and openness and compassion and healing insight, they are still valuable. So they are good to use. It's just that you don't have to argue with someone about your God is better than their God, or your vision is better than their vision, or your ritual is better than their ritual. This is the immaturity. This is the piece we don't quite get yet. And I'm sure you're hearing how this affects everything that's happening to us in the world today, and the political polarization and religion becoming part of politics. Well, you know, in a very real sense, of course, religion will be part of politics, but not organized religion, not ideological religion, but religion in the way that I use the word, which is the way it originally evolved, what it meant, was the link to that which is greater. When we stand in the presence of the link to that which is greater, we are guided, we are inspired. Our intuition and our faith become one power that keeps unfolding and guiding and leading and helping us over some of our rigid spots, some of our defense mechanisms, some of our preconceived ideas that we're very attached to. That to begin to let go of some of these preconceived ideas feels like a whole cascade, like a domino effect. A whole cascade of other things are going to have to shift, and we don't really want to do that. We don't want to mess them up. They seem to be working okay, so we resist. But the truth of the matter is, we can relax about it. We can consider it. We can be more open-minded. We can be more gentle. We can be more compassionate. We don't have to be so hasty to be right. We don't have to speak fast. We don't have. It's so interesting. I just saw this woman. I'm not going to mention her name, but I know all of you will know who this woman with very anorexic, angry woman, and she just talks like knives shooting out of a machine gun. Her words and the energy in her mouth. This is a person in tremendous fear who's very wounded, who believes that by nihilistic energy, which is often what happens when people are wounded and they don't have a positive way to create, because to go to the positive state of mind makes them feel horrifically vulnerable. And so they encapsulate it, or someone like her doesn't even bother encapsulating, it's just her modus operandi. And the fact that she is an archetype, that she appeals to people, it shows that the people she appeals to have a similar problem. They feel powerless and very angry. And they don't want to go through the process of innocence and kindness to heal, because that puts them in direct connection to their own pain, which is quite considerable, and they don't want to look at it. They're occasionally, thank God, very, very rarely. And people in my life or counseling who just say, I don't want to change and I won't. I won't look at it. I won't do it. And these people stay angry their whole lives. I mean, hopefully some point in their life it will change, but to the moment it's still that way. And the thing is that faith is about having the heart to sense the link to that which is greater and be guided by it. It's not really just faith in things unseen. They may be unseen and it is still faith. That's not really the definition. The definition is the experience of the connection to the inspiration in the heart and the spirit with a capital S. You know, the presence of God, the numinous sense. But people who are angry, and, you know, it's so funny, I just thought of a person, which I'm sure no, very few listeners know who he is. I only sort of knew him peripherally, and it was many, many, many years ago. He was a friend of William Buckley. And William Buckley had a program, and he interviewed this Malcolm Muggeridge's name. And Malcolm Muggeridge was really a curmudgeon-y kind of guy, and a curmudgeon-y, just grumpy, mean-speaking, a little bit like this lady I just was talking about, not quite as strongly that way. But he, at some point in his life, later in his life, white-haired, he had a religious experience. He felt the link to that which is greater. And he was a Christian, and that's what he was talking to William Buckley about, and I never forget this show, because William Buckley was so in awe of Malcolm Muggeridge, one as a journalist who was sharp-tongued, but also as one who had found faith and had believed now in what Christ taught, and realized that love really was key. And Jesus didn't just say that over and over again for nothing. It actually was the thing you had to get in touch with. And of course, he let himself love God, which is one of the ways we begin to love ourselves and other people, if we genuinely love God. And that's why Jesus said that was, you know, such an important commandment, is that you love God with all your heart and all your being and all your soul. When you do that, you change your being and your soul and your body, because you let God in. And when you let God in, that's faith. And so he asked Malcolm Muggeridge about how, I remember he said something about how you can't, he said, you know, he said, you can't talk in sort of public company. You just can't talk about God. To Malcolm Muggeridge, he said, like, you know, if you're at a dinner party, you just can't bring up God. And Malcolm Muggeridge says, why not? I do all the time. And I realized, you know, it was the difference between a believer and a non-believer. And what was really interesting is that the believer was somebody like Paul, you know, St. Paul, who was on the road to Damascus, you know, he's killing Christians, hated Jesus, hated everything about Christianity. And he had an enlightening experience. He had an epiphany, and he understood what Jesus was teaching, and it was like a shift in the way his brain worked. And this is a very real phenomenon, and it's happening more and more. When people used to go to my workshops, you know, as I say, decades pass, and through the last 35 years, they leave changed, and especially in those beginning 15, 20 years, when this information that I was certainly teaching was just not out. It just didn't exist, and it sounded so unreal or unsayable that people actually sort of like went into trance when they were sitting in the workshop. Some people would burst into tears. Some people's eyes would sort of glaze over, and their eyelids would flutter, and their mouth would fall open. And I'd realize as I scanned the audience, you know, I could see a few hundred people, and I could see these different pockets where I would say certain things, when it would be filled with energy, a spirit of really transformation, of really empowering, putting into the voice and the being and the idea of what we're talking about, the shifting experience. their linear mind could not contain it. They had to kind of go into this sort of trance. And an acupuncturist friend of mine said to me one time, I said something about how I'd spent so many years going around the planet and speaking to a third of a million people and planting seeds, and that a lot of the seeds are coming to fruition, but they're still kind of confused. I mean, they're not really straight quite yet. And he said, he made a really nice comment. He said, you know, Patricia, you didn't just plant seeds. You planted seeds that were fully germinated. And while that's a very nice thing that he said about me, it also is something I wanted to say to you, because when you share an experience from the experience place, when you tell somebody something that inspired you, or healed you, or was a revelation, or an epiphany, or an insight, when you tell someone who's receptive, being, and you do it tenderly and not judgmentally, and not, you know, strutting across the stage like you know and they don't know, and it got energetically ego putting them down, even though the words are right and the experience. When people do that, it's not their experience that they're sharing. They're sharing somebody else's experience, and they're using it for the power of being important. And it's very necessary to talk about this, because part of our discernment and our maturity collectively is we have to discern the difference, because in the discerning the difference between the sort of fake using good words and good information just to have power over people and to look important, that's immature, and it has the energetic connection of fear and immaturity in it. So it hampers the development of the insight. And we need to learn to discern that, because that hampers our development if we don't, and it is part of our development to do it. And one might even make the case that they exist so as to be an example of what it isn't, so that we can discern it and see what it feels like when you have the actual revelation revealed energetically as someone speaks it or shares their experience. This is the intuitive mind integrating into life, into communication. And the superstition is just trying to capture the power without really having the integration. And as I say that, then, I want to go back to what I started to say before, that some rituals, some superstitions are like bookmarks. I remember I used to take people on tours of the world, different places I wanted to go that I thought were wonderful, you know, Japan and Italy and Ireland and Spain and Australia, many places, Israel and Egypt, and have people tune into the culture and the thinking, and to be really ambassadors who took many trips to the Soviet Union when it was the Soviet Union, and help that transition, help that integration. So it was good for the people who came on the trip. They got to see, you know, an interesting place in the world, but also to be goodwill ambassadors, to be healers, to look at things and speak of things from the point of view of integration and healing and inspiration and insight. And when we did that, there were occasions where people, I remember, especially like when we were in Italy and in France and European cathedrals, and it's been a dream of mine to do a tour of the European cathedrals, and the only reason I haven't done it is one, it's a lot of work, and it'll of necessity be quite expensive, because you have to keep moving from one place to another. And but in any case, someday I'm going to do it. And what was often a comment, both in Egypt and the temples in Egypt, which are quite awesome, and the ancient cathedrals in Europe, was if you let yourself walk into it, there would be such awe. I mean, there really, if you let yourself feel the building, the architecture was a design inspired space that caused you to experience faith and inspiration. And it was a sort of a physical thing that generated intuition and spirit. And so I would comment on that, and I would describe all the symbols, because I love religion, and I love their symbolism. It's only the orthodoxy and the rules I don't care for. I love all the symbolism. I love the different kinds of symbolism, the many ways to experience God and to be inspired. And it's so enriching. And so when we would go into a cathedral, there would be different things that I would explain. And many times I would have what people could identify themselves as lapsed Catholics. And they would be kind of angry at the church. And indeed, there were many abuses in the Catholic Church, Inquisition to be not the least of them. And the current stuff that goes on. But that's the human part. That's the part where we are immature, wounded, dysfunctional, and hiding behind power and control, and are really weak and immature and not digested our injuries. And so that's why it causes crime, it causes the harm, it causes cruelty. But the religion, the link to that which is greater, whether it's Catholicism, which is after the first couple hundred years after Jesus, that was Christianity until Martin Luther did the Reformation, because they had gotten so bad, they had gotten so political, so cruelly using beautiful faith, beautiful words of Jesus, beautiful insight. And so this happens in religion. This happens when human beings are immature and don't get it. But what I started to say is it acts like a bookmark, these rituals, these stories, these ceremonies. And when we would walk into a cathedral, I remember one time, I think it was in Chartres, and walked in and I said to the people that were with me, isn't it amazing what presence you can feel in these old cathedrals? Oh, and I remember too, another time, this happened many times actually, so that's why I'm confusing, it happened in Spain, it happened in France, and it happened in Italy in the Duomo in Florence. And I was doing a show or part of a group that was part of a conference, and where I was a speaker, and we were doing a show for the BBC, and they were filming, I guess, the conference in Florence and some of the things that people were talking about, and I was in the Duomo with them, and they were actually already inside, and I arrived just about a minute or two later, and I came through the side door by myself, and as I entered into the space, because the Duomo was closed, the church was closed, the cathedral was closed for the filming, for the interview, for the production, and they had some docents there who were guided, you know, to be consulted and who were guarding me being there. So when I first came through, I came through the side door where we were supposed to come in, and as I came in the side door, I felt the presence of the building, the form, the energy of it, and it's a sort of trancey state, but not excessively, just a little trancey feeling, and I had this very strong inner feeling that it was very important that you enter this building from the front door. It was built to be entered from the front door. So I sort of scooted around inside and positioned myself in front of the front doors, which were closed. And almost like my head down and my eyes semi-closed just to get there. And as I stood at that spot, I lifted my head and I opened my eyes and I let the feeling of the church come in. And as it did, I could see the design in the marble in the floor. There was a kind of center line, which was about an inch and a quarter off. It had moved, but I could feel that it had moved, but it was still the straight line that I could feel, though there was no straight line. It was the design. And I began walking down this line with my head up, not real far, but just lifted up, and with this presence of this feeling. And as I walked down the center, there was the cathedral, the dome, and there were paintings on the inside of the dome, and there was a skylight at the very top, so the light was coming through the dome, and there were arches above, you know, the cathedral's in the shape of a cross, and I'm entering at the foot of the cross, and there's the dome is in the center where the heart is. Anyway, so I'm walking along, and there's these apexes of arches above my head, and I'm beginning to see, you know, with perspective, as I walk, each arch, the point of each arch, centers and intersects and lifts up the next arch, and centers and lifts up the next arch. And as I was feeling that, I was feeling the top of my head almost lift off, open, until I got to the dome. And at the dome, there are paintings, and it's first of earth, and then there's Jesus sitting in a throne on the earth, and people and saints around him, and then there are angels as it goes, and then if you see his head, there's like a line that comes out of his head, and it goes straight up to the top where there's a dove, which is the Holy Spirit, and it's at the base of the skylight where the light is, and it says, Iseomo, this is man. And this is what man is to be. This is a living metaphor, architecture, parable, existence, experience, design. And it was so powerful. Everybody was looking at me and said, what happened? And I explained it. And then people were running down and doing it and going, oh, my goodness, and the docent went down and they ran and they walked and they watched and they said, oh my goodness. And they came up to me and they said, how did you know this? How did you know about this? And I said, well, I just felt it. You know, when I walked in, I could feel it, and it felt important to go at the front door and walk this way, and it just happened. And then I said, well, you know, we don't really realize how these buildings were built, because they weren't really designed or created by architects the way we normally think of creating something. What was wonderful about the architects and the builders is they let spirit design it. And that's why it has this quality. They didn't have, linear intellectual knowledge. They did, of course, to build the building and everything, but not the form, not the inspiration. That spirit built. And as I'm telling them this, these two docents, I'll never forget their faces. Their eyes went real wide and their mouths opened. They said, oh. And they said, just a minute. And they patted my hand and they ran off and they came back with a card, which, you know, it was printed in different languages because this one was in English. And it said, it's a quote from, I think it was Bernini, I'm not sure now, I'm sorry, I forgot. But the man who designed, the architect that built the building, it was his letter to the builders, to the workmen. And in it, and it's just a little paragraph because it's just a section, and it says, please know that I did not design this building. Let the spirit that designed it move you and guide you as you build it. So that's intuition. That's faith. That's spirit. That's whole brain thinking. That's the heaven on earth. That's when men and women love each other in that kind of energy. When they make love in that kind of energy. When they raise children in that kind of energy. When we teach in schools with that kind of energy, when we govern in politics with that kind of trust, that's what faith is. Faith isn't about imprisoning or starting wars or making rules or laws to coerce other people, ever. It is about living the beauty of it. For some reason, it reminds me of Lao Tzu, who said, "He who loves the world as his body may be entrusted with the empire." And he was really just saying, if you really love the world in a spiritual way, like we should love our bodies, if you love all the people and all of the land and all of the plants and all of the animals, and you see it as the body of God, and you respect it, well, then you can be entrusted to be political. And you would never probably talk about it, or at least seldom, because you'd walk in it. You'd live it. And that's why Lao Tzu also said, he who knows does not speak, who speaks does not know. Doesn't mean you can't speak. Doesn't mean we couldn't share. Just means you know the people who are always strutting across the stage making a pronouncement. Without the love, without the compassion, they don't know. They don't really know. They know it taught. They know it moved people. They know it was valuable. But they don't know it, because they would share it in a different way. They would generate it with the love. They would acknowledge where they learned it. They would be open. They would be kinder. They wouldn't need to put people down. They wouldn't need to be dominating. So this is part of what we're all learning, to allow that beauty, that joy, the power of vision that lets us become whole. And it's why we have to work on ourselves. Because, you know, in thinking about it again, he said, he who knows others is wise. He who knows himself is enlightened. And knowing yourself is about recognizing all these connections, these seeing where you're wounded, working on it, thinking from your heart, acting from your heart. As my grandson sang to me when he was 5 years old, a song, I know I've already said this before, but I'm so touched by it. He sang to me a song, and one of the lines was, "Follow your heart and you'll believe in yourself forever." And Carl Jung said, "Your vision will become clear only when you look into your heart. Who looks outside dreams. Who looks inside awakens." And this is the idea that when you are awake, you are connected to that which is greater, and you are a walking beacon of it. And that's why you no longer have to force people to know things. Sure, you will share it. Sure, you will talk. But it will come with no attachment or agreement. No attachment or getting power from it. Other than the power of the delight of doing it and feeling it and feeling the wonderful power of aliveness and joy that gets created. So you do it for its own sake. That is awake. And that isn't either or. It doesn't mean you can't make a living. It doesn't mean you can't go do things and pay you for your time. But truly, that energy is something that we are, as a species, maturing and evolving to become aware of, to live in, to walk in, to work on ourselves, to self-correct. The piece of the planet we're sitting in. This is the only piece of the planet you have control. Otherwise, it's you have 100% power of response from your piece to the whole piece. And that's why I used to say too, you know, 100% you create your world, but also 100% the world creates you. So you are 100% at effect of the world and the universe, and 100% you affect the world and the universe. So the peace you are to work on is the peace you sit in. People who don't like self-contemplation, people who don't want to have self-esteem, reflection. Just want to be reactionary. Follow their emotions of especially anger or judgment and judgmentalness. Are almost mentally ill because it is so deranged from the place of healing and maturity and growth, and it lashes out. It causes harm. And as we begin to see that, we feel the ugliness of it. We feel the pain that people who habitually do that create. That's our mirror to not do that when we feel so inclined, as we all will sometimes feel so inclined. And it is the power to just observe it, to do your best to change it, to see what else could be done for correction at the source, to be inspired, to see what else could you think of that would make it have a different response or have another way to handle it or another way to address it, or even perhaps sometimes the power to just let it go and ignore it. And not in a self-sacrificing way, not in a martyr, victimized way, which sometimes we have to do when we can't figure out the more powerful way to let it go. Because sometimes things that are very important and hugely transformative take decades to transform. And you should not feel impatient that you're working on something, because all the time I hear, Patricia's been working on this for 30 years, I don't want to have to keep working on it. And some people say, I've been working on this for 2 years, and I don't want to have to keep working on it. The truth of the matter is, the more difficult something is to transform, the more powerful and valuable is the transformation. The more healing, the more revealing, the more aligning, the more integrating to you personally and as an energy contribution to the world. Because as you heal and rectify and enlighten and awaken yourself, this radiates out as you walk along. I know this from firsthand experience, because when I was teaching and very open and had no limitation on it, when I would walk down the streets, I remember in Moscow, in Boston, in places all over the world, my aura would be large, and people who were in front of me would turn around to see who was behind them. And I remember one time this man, I came into a library, and there's no one in this rare books room. This is one man. And when I walked into it, he said, I think it was in a church, this was in Boston. And he said, "Who are you?" it's like, he didn't mean that. He didn't care who I was, particularly. He wanted to know, what is this energy I feel? What is this? And this is growing. You know, I can remember when Star Wars first came out, I was so thrilled when they talked about the Force. You know, the Force do with you. Listen to the Force. Now, the dark side of the Force is just our fear of the Force. The dark side of the Force is just wanting to have power over people and thinking that's the Force. The Force is you don't have any power or control over anybody, nor do you wish to. You just want to be alive and awake and alight and have the joy of discovery of being alive and interact with people at that level. That's being awake. That's living with the Force, letting it move through you and heal you, and you empower its existence because you let it join with matter. It's the descent of spirit into matter. You let it come into being. So this is what we are learning to do. And interestingly, it all comes from our fears and our wounds and our stuck stuff, the places where we won't let things happen, or we won't let ourselves feel something, and we contort our life force into a kind of controlling power over that is generated by anger and woundedness and injury, and that doesn't work. It only causes war. It only causes fighting in a relationship. It only causes harm to children. It does not heal patients when doctors need to be right, when they don't acknowledge how abysmally unaware they are about healing it. So this is the coming home. This is the awakening. And this is how our intuition transcends superstition and we fulfill ourselves with faith. Thank you so much for listening. And until next week, this is Patricia Sun wishing you love.
You've been listening to Trust the Problem with Patricia Sun. This program and its content is copywritten to Patricia Sun, all rights reserved, 2006.